the intersection of information and conversation. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Hello, and thanks for joining me this afternoon from Australia. We are broadcasting out of our studios in the Gold Coast, but we will talk to people from all around the world, as we always do here on TNT, especially on the weekend. There is so much to get through. Big, big show today. And I hope you enjoyed yesterday's program. There was some fabulous interviews, and Dr. Chetty was just something else. And if you'd like to catch up with that or other interviews, you just need to go to the TNT website, tntradio.live, click on episodes, look for your favorite presenter, and you can see all of the previous shows listed there, both on video and audio for your convenience. You can even download them to listen to or watch later. This is the only place for the best coverage, uninterrupted by mainstream narrative and agendas. We just deal with the facts, and that means we can talk about virtually anything here on TNT Radio, and that makes it all the more refreshing. Well, in today's Australian newspaper, a horrific hit piece was delivered against Julian Assange, with the headline, Assange's Sordid Tale of Treachery. It reads, Julian Assange is a criminal, a fabulist, and an undisciplined, arrogant, workshy fraud who lacks an education while remaining a mannerless vulgarian. The WikiLeaks founder is no journalist. Well, that's Alan Howe taking no prisoners, himself a history and obituaries editor, deciding to write a 9-minute piece to basically pull apart a fellow Australian as he tries to get out of prison, where he's been locked up for 5 years in maximum security for the work of being a journalist, despite what Howe wants to argue. Very disturbing piece there, but it just shows you there's no end of apologists for intelligence agencies and diplomats who are able to cover up certain crimes and put a title on as classified. If that's all it needs, that's what you do. You can get away with murder, literally, which is what Assange's work was partly to do with. Well, on today's show, big lineup, as I said, and I'm going to introduce you to my first guest in a moment, and his name is Professor Brian Fitzgerald. We're going to talk about a subject that all of us probably at one stage or more in our lifetimes have considered. Do we have a soul, and can it be resurrected? It's a fabulous idea, isn't it? But this is something that's been explored for, well, at least 1700 years, and that's what we're going to discuss today in his brand new essay that's come out to explore biblical scholarship. Also on the show today, I'm going to speak to former prison officer and whistleblower at Dublin FCI, Tess Corth, because she's been on this show recently as a whistleblower exposing the horrors in that prison, including sexual abuse. Well, you're not going to believe it. A surprise announcement this week. The prison is being closed down, and Tess will be on the show in the next hour to give us an update of what's going on there. Dr. Carol Lieberman, psychiatrist, will be coming up straight after to talk about O.J. Simpson, the case, and how it is that people can deal with being victims and not being heard as the wrongful killing case that went against Simpson, and that whole story that blows out from then on. And wasn't O.J. Simpson a character who had it all and seemingly destroyed it, the American dream to become the American villain? Then we're going to speak to Peter Richards, Australian veteran, on the eve of Anzac Day here in Australia that will be commemorated this coming Thursday, and also get an update of the various military activities or actions, wars that are being fought around the world at the moment. Peter is always on top of things. It'll be great to be able to catch up. And in the final hour of today's show, filmmaker and journalist Nicole McCaw will join me to discuss her film Border Wars and a broader picture. She's been very close to what's happening in the Trump campaign and has got some interesting things to say, she assures me. So I'm really looking forward to speaking to her and all of our guests today. Now, how does one contemplate loss in terms of eternity? How does one contemplate their own demise in the physical world? How do we contemplate in terms of our soul? What is a soul? And some might consider resurrection of the soul, but could that be possible? Well, Brian Fitzpatrick's essay not only offers a scholarly exploration of St. Gregory's philosophical masterpiece, but also serves as a bridge between ancient wisdom and contemporary understanding. By explaining the timeless relevance of these discussions, he illuminates the enduring interplay between reason and revelation within Christian thought, inviting readers to engage deeply with the fundamental questions of existence and faith. Well, Brian Fitzgerald is an independent scholar, an adjunct professor at Eastern University, and long-term Orthodox Christian with publications at Liverpool University Press, the Abdul Hamid Shoman Foundation, and the annual of the Department of Antiquities of Jordan. He also has special interest in Byzantine and Syriac Christian history and theology, as well as Roman, late antique, Byzantine, and Middle Eastern history in general. Well, Professor Brian Fitzgerald, welcome to Weekends.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to join you.
Terrific. I'm pleased that you've been able to join us on your Saturday evening to talk about what for most people at one stage in their life is the ultimate question. What happens after we die? But before we get there, to understand how it even occurs in terms of separating the physical body and this idea of a soul that pretty much everyone on earth at one stage or another considers that they must have, and yet scientifically we don't quite understand what's really going on. But your research, your writing in this goes way back in the period of the fourth century, where this has already been written about. And so it's a fabulous update, if you will, and study of history and writing to, in many ways, be able to bring it up to speed in terms of what we now understand in the 21st century. Can you tell me what made you decide at this stage to, first of all, put pen to paper, so to speak, and provide this new analysis?
Well, in a way, it's not that new. I mean, obviously, the writings of Gregory of Nyssa have been around for over a millennium. Really, we're dealing with late 300s, late 4th century. As far as my own paper, which has just been published, actually, it's a PDF format, a written format of a lecture I gave 20 years ago at what was then my home parish. And it seems that, as many such things do, I had a series of lectures I gave because, you know, that's my background, history, Christianity, Christian thought. And I gave some lectures at my own parish for adult education courses, then decided, well, you know, none of these are really meant to be scholarly works. They were meant to be introductions to help people who were interested in reading Christian patristic literature to have an introduction to it, using publications which are English translations, which are approachable with good introductions. So people get into the habit of reading these things themselves. The point of the introduction being would be to give the kind of background and fill in the sort of intellectual background that might help a more casual reader make sense of it. And I delivered such lectures 20 years ago, placed it on the internet, and found out that it had these lectures seem to have had a vaster afterlife on the internet than in a few hours or so that I was giving the lectures. And true discovery of this lecture 20 years later. The reason I mention is because, you know, I'm an Orthodox Christian myself, and, you know, so the Greek and the Syriac fathers are various authoritative authors and sources for our faith. And actually, they're, you know, quite authoritative in the Catholic Church well, and are of high interest to many other people, like they might be Lutherans, Anglicans, or whatever they might be. So, and, you know, this is something that's been of interest to me for some time. And I found that especially my, you know, particular, since I like both, you know, Syriac and Byzantine fathers, I found that their approach to theology and many of these discussions, life, the soul, the afterlife, eternal life, and so forth, comparatively amenable. And the reason why I do so is, like, particularly a lot of discussions about the soul, obviously the main thing is it is obviously asserting the existence of soul, particularly as a life force behind the human body. They're not understanding it to be primarily life as a physiological thing, like a physical force. Like, if you were to speak with a physicist or whatever, of course, it's the nature of a physicist to study the physical universe. So such things as a soul, if they were, you know, not some sort of epiphenomenon to our physical beings, they won't be discoverable there anyway. But of course, the fathers, and I think most Christians say, well, it would not be found in such a way. It's not like an extra organ or something in our body. The way Gregory of Nyssa understood it and many of the fathers was, is it was the life-giving force that gave force to the body. Without a soul, the body doesn't live. And one of the key things understanding, now the terminology that Gregory used might be somewhat different than you get as it develops in the Byzantine, the Eastern Orthodox understanding does develop over time and finally reaches its more mature forms with people like Maximus the Confessor in the 600s, but particularly also later Gregory of Palamas, talking about things like participate, the whole developing concept of theosis and being able to commune with God through his energies and so forth, which we'll probably discuss a bit here. But there would be a concept of, obviously the body with its sensations, the soul, which is, and then you have what would be, in many of these later scholars, they would talk about the intellect or nous, which we might call spirit, often thinking spirit, soul, body. It's not exactly the same, but it's kind of analogous. And the point being, and this is something Gregory's getting at, is what's key to our wholeness as human beings, our salvation, so to speak, is the proper direction of the soul. Is that the soul is to keep control of the body and its and the emotions, the apparatus. It keeps it alive, and the body is actually of very great importance. But the soul itself is to be in communion with God. And so there's a kind of pattern of communion with God, the spirit, directing the soul, which then directs the body, which then leads to a happy, a contented life and the possibility for eternal life. And the idea behind Christian redemption, especially amongst the Orthodox, is, and Gregory discusses this a bit in the rather language he does, especially when he's kind of playing the devil's advocate against his sister Macrino, who's in this text is providing the supposedly correct Christian answers. Actually, they're his own, but he's putting them in her mouth. What he's in effect saying is that we are to be restored not to some condition that we now experience since we live in a fallen world and we are still in somewhat of a fallen state, but we are, after the resurrection of the dead and the fullness of time, we'll be brought to the condition that we were intended to be brought into, fully divinized. And some will say, Gregory seems to say it this way, as in the garden. Others will actually say, I think from the Syrians and others like this, so you'll see this is not really like that, because in the garden, we were still in an indeterminate or immature state and had to make the choice whether to eat or not of the fruit of the tree of good and evil. And we chose wrongly with sad results, of our current fallen world and fallen selves. We're to be restored to the state that we would be in had we obeyed. And that's the other argument. Gregory of Nyssa kind of, some will say it's going back to the beginning. Others say this state. In the end, effectively, it's into the blessed state that God intended us to be created in. And so you'll find that Gregory spends a lot of time like saying, well, what age will we be at? Or what will it be the old body? Would it be punished for the sins of the young body? All this kind of stuff. And a lot of the questions per se that it's answering, many people I think reading this would think like, well, who thinks like that these days? Well, chances are not very many. And I think the thing that we have to draw from it is that, first of all, he was speaking in the late 4th century, and he was addressing several things. People who might have been Plato, there's a big mishmash of Neoplatonism, Stoicism, and God knows what else at this time. It's kind of hard. You had certain specific Neoplatonist people that we know, like Plotinus or whatever. In later centuries, you would have Proclus and others. But, the specific arguments he's dealing with, like particularly classical positions you might see sometimes, like against Aristotle, against the kind of more materialist understanding, or against certain Neoplatonisms like transmigrations of souls and so forth. These would have been very current in his day. So in a way, you could say that he was actually engaging in a direct intellectual and philosophical discussion for his time, which means that, some of the specific answers aren't going to be very convincing for us. For example, like you know, like the soul, how is it, what does a resurrection mean? How is a body reattached to the spirit? Well, he seems to, he indicates, well, because the soul, you know, is in its, in thought and so forth, can be transported any place it wants to be in a moment. It's fully aware of, it's not bound by time or space. So it's to be able to be attached with the various loose pieces of the body as it degenerates over time. And that's probably not very convincing to us. But you know, he's making what might then be considered a plausible argument. And I think what's also interesting is that, you know, if ever heard things like when they sometimes in the Muslim world or whatever, during times over history, if people really wanted to aggravate Orthodox Christians, they mess around with their graveyards, like stirring up graves and so forth. That's considered a grave impiety to do that. Well, with the kind of philosophy that Gregory of Nyssa is talking about, you could see that as a background, how that, those sort of sentiments may have developed. I think the key thing that we need to direct from is not so much focus on these specific arguments, but to think that we do have a soul, that our life is not just a set of physiological drives. Not that, you know, we deny that. I think that's very important, because we do live in a world where it's pretty much dominated by materialism and financial transactions, and that's not an easy environment to maintain spiritual values. So we don't live in a society where at least in the West and many other places in highly industrialized societies, it seems that we tend to, there's kind of a natural tendency towards a certain materialism, perhaps nihilism in that. In some ways we can, I would say that religious assumptions don't sit as naturally for many of us as it may once have done so. And that's just, so we have to exercise at it a bit more. Yeah. So I think the thing for us to take is not to accept the materialist understanding only, but that we do have a living forth of soul, as we would speak it, something that's survives death. I wouldn't say it's the true us. That's not really true. It's part of the true us, because the body is part of the true us too in the Orthodox tradition. Otherwise, why would you care about the resurrection of the body? Just go to heaven with your soul and you're fine. That's not what we understand. It's that the resurrection is the restoration of the human being, body, soul, and spirit, to be rewoven, fully divinized in communion with God, but still fully ourselves, and in due time, and in this state that we are intended to be created in. And to understand, like, what the things he's getting at, I would say, is understanding the soul as a spiritual force. The key thing is the proper orientation, how we orient ourselves, to orient ourselves to God and to discipline our body. And what I mean by discipline the body is not necessarily flagellism or something like that. Of course, he was pretty ascetical, and so were his brothers, being involved with monasteries and bishops and stuff, and very ascetical themselves. But their understanding is that such things like emotions out of control, what they would call the passions, let's say uncontrollable anger or whatever it might be, uncontrollable greed or some, any of the undesirable traits, or even good emotions like love or whatever, that it kind of go on, if we let it go unbounded. They understand if we're driven by such things, basically they're not, he says it's not properly part of the soul. He understands it as kind of in that borderline of where the soul and the body interact, and it's there. And he's going by his.
Sorry to cut in there, Brian. I just making note, we've got to cut to a break, but what's really important is that this is the split that we're going to explore now that makes it very relevant for all people who are watching and listening. In the meantime, what we'll do is we'll take our first break and we'll come back and we'll get into more of the detail. It's a fabulous analysis, and I want you to be able to understand deeply. But first of all, why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all the major social platforms, including Facebook, X, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right on here on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT's Jason Burmis.
Now, whether you like Donald Trump or you think he's literally Hitler, have we ever been in a situation where a person who has led this country could not take a day off from what is obviously a show trial in every respect, way, shape, and form, to go see their kid graduate high school? Oh, Jason, He's a billionaire. He doesn't care. That's his, like, fifth kid. Who cares? How dare you, Jason? He's already got Don Jr. and Eric. He got to go to those. Look, the bottom line is this is grotesque on every level, and it shows how lawfare is being waged against anyone who goes against the narrative, even the President of the United States. And this is very dangerous.
Jason Burmis on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country is all about.
TNT Radio.
And welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour is Professor Brian Fitzgerald, talking about the soul and resurrection, analyzing the work of St. Gregory of Nyssa from somewhere back in the 4th century, if you can believe that. And there's something wonderful when scholarship can transfer some 1,700 years or more, and we can talk about it and analyze it in terms of today and develop the concepts that were spoken about so eloquently back in the day. Brian, it's a fascinating story because for most people, when they realize that there might well be something after this existence, that there can be separation from physical body into this invisible soul, as it were, then you realize that there's a whole eternity out there beyond the 80-odd years that you might get from birth. It changes the way we consider everything, the way that we might well behave. And therefore, understanding that how we live this life certainly determines what might happen after. I found this part fascinating within it, because this is where you start to explore the idea. For example, I'm just going to try and find a quote here to share with you. The soul is finite, but the divine is infinite, as one such example. I was hoping that you might be able to expand on that concept.
Well, what it's talking about is that Gregory understands, as most the Christian scholars, you know, like theologians could say, is humanity was created after image and likeness of God. Now, Gregory of Nyssa, now the typical standing Orthodox Church is that's the entire human being, not just the soul, but body, soul, and spirit. Not that God has limbs and hands and so forth, but it's a whole human being is created that way. Gregory of Nyssa particularly concentrates more on the soul, and he'll say that it's an intellectual substance, as is the divine substance, but it's not the same. But it's like, he said, he makes an image, like, for example, if you see the reflection of the sun in the shard of a glass, you're obviously not seeing the full sun, but only as much as the shard of glass can reflect, but yet that's still a true reflection. And he would make it, he's using analogy with the human soul that way. So obviously the divine nature would be infinite, and also in its utter otherness, totally inaccessible to us, but still by grace is acceptable by his mercies. Later fathers would call that through his energies. But Gregory of Nyssa wouldn't have said that yet. That took some time to figure out. So the soul would be of a similar essence and thus has a certain affinity in itself, if unsullied by the fall, toward the divine. And this is the key thing. I'll just summarize what I was saying earlier, is having the orientation of the soul toward the divine, toward the spiritual, and mastering the body and the passions, not getting rid of them, but, you know, not letting itself be dominated by them. So the proper direction, let's think, like, put it in terms we might commonly think, spirit, soul, body. That's how I normally say that, the spirit or the nous, intellect or whatever, directing the soul, and the soul directing the body, rather than having the body directing the soul and reversing polarity, so to speak. So the point is that we are to have communion with God, and through time and practice and so forth in the faith, we're able to orient ourselves more spiritually and thus bring our spirit, soul and body into harmony. And that's the goal of the Orthodox Christian tradition. And actually, really, generally speaking, all traditions, Christian traditions, really. We might elaborate it rather different, have different notions like theosis or divinization, which is ongoing communion with God, which somehow, by God's mercy, is capable with us and is able to cleanse us and to help us reweave ourselves more after the fashion which God intended us to be woven. And that's really what the intention that he's getting at there. And what he's talking about with the soul being finite and infinite, obviously the soul is not the same as God, but there is a likeness. And I found that his image of the reflection of the sun in the shard of the glass is a pretty good analogy in a way. So that, yeah, there is a real reflection of the divine, and we can even learn a lot about divinity by if we really start studying ourselves and how things are arranged within us and the orderly arrangement and so forth. It's not necessarily going to be a particular contemplation of the natural sciences, which I think are quite valuable. It's rather more of a philosophical approach and understanding and going in with certain assumptions about the orderliness of creation and ourselves and so forth. So it starts with some religious assumptions, but it's a sense of spiritual wholeness and interwovenness, which is the goal there. And that's what I think he's driving at. And I think it's good to focus on these rather than some of the specific arguments he's making, since he is speaking in a specific setting, which he would have been quite relevant. To us, it would sound a little alien at points. But his general points, even though they have been spoken differently in later centuries in the Orthodox Christian tradition, essentially, I mean, he's one of the big scholars, one of the big writers in this field, and he's referred to a lot. And then, as you know, then improved by commentary later on, let's say.
Now, when we consider just from a very, very basic individual human being, considering what we've just heard, is there a connection between just normal human emotions and the body or the soul? How does that get explained here?
Well, his way he looks at it, and he uses a citation like with regard to Moses being meek. And so he says, well, obviously Moses wasn't angry, and he didn't have that emotion. So it was not, that couldn't be essential to his soul at that point. It had to be what he considered accidental and, you know, something that could be associated with his soul, but was not a necessary condition for it. It's not part of its substance, so to speak. Part of his also ground would be is that, and this would be something universal amongst the fault, is emotions like our emotional understanding of love or hate or anger or happiness or good or bad or whatever. You know, God is other, is immovable, unchangeable, is beyond all these kind of concepts. So what, you know, physiologically, we obviously would tend to say these things are coming out of the body. The way Gregory of Nyssa understands it, since it's not part of the soul, since the soul is an intellectual substance and can exist without these things, it seems, and he gives the example of Moses, a pretty selected one, because there are other times when Moses got angry and he smote the rock instead of speaking to it, so I think he was a little selective in the scriptural sources. But his point was, is that where the emotions arise is in the interaction between the soul and the body, that kind of borderland is the way he himself is putting it. And the point is that not that they're supposed to go away. It's when they're out of control, they're not properly ordered, is when the issue arises. When properly ordered and directed properly, love of one's neighbor is good. That's a good thing. Love of doing nasty things is bad. Love of money is bad, but love of doing good, helping others, that's a good thing. Anger, especially if it leads to violence and things that are reprehensible, is bad, but anger at one's own sin in the sense that I did something wrong and I really don't want to do it again, and a little anger at oneself over such a thing, or anger at obvious injustices. You know, we're mentioning Julian Assange, for example, would be a pretty good case there, in my opinion. I think it's a very good example of where anger would be appropriate. That they, you know, especially if it's leading to actions and attitudes and things that are helpful and contribute in a positive way, instead of us going out and punching somebody in the face or something. You know, it's the emotions. That's where he's putting it. We'll have different among different Christian fathers, and I'm not an expert in all of them. Obviously, there are far too many. But they might explain things rather differently, the way they're breaking down body, soul, spirit, this sort of stuff. They sometimes use different languages. I know Macarius of Egypt will tend to speak of the heart, really is more of the center, where amongst many of the Greek fathers, especially the Cappadocians, are going to think of intellect, nous, or the mind. You know, so the reality underneath it is the same, but they are using somewhat different terms. But in any case, the point being is that they are a part of us. It's, you know, Gregory of Nyssa's own understanding is this interaction between the body and soul leading to them. Well, you know, in his own day, that was certainly been, you know, I get, it would been a point that he could have made. I don't know whether everybody would have bought it or not, but he is speaking in a specific intellectual and cultural and philosophical discussion his day, taking into account the currents of his day. And I think that in itself is probably a good example for us of how we should present, you know, if we're interested in the Christian message, how we should discuss it, to be aware of, you know, current sciences, philosophy, psychology, and so forth. And, you know, interacting with it, you know, accepting what we believe is true and being critical about other things that we might think are rather incomplete or perhaps short-sighted. And that certainly was what he was trying to do. And so in any case, the point of his thing with emotions, whether we accept his definition of how they came about, his point is that they're not bad. They're neutral, actually. It's how they're directed and used. And as long as they're directed, you know, by the soul in a godly way, you know, as later fathers might say, directed by the intellect of the nous, and therefore the person being brought back in that sort of spiritual harmony, they can be a very good thing. It's when we're kind of balance, like I say, kind of in reverse polarity, driven from body up rather than spirit down, that we have our spiritual problems. And the whole point, just an aside, but I won't get onto it, is the whole idea of asceticism. People don't realize the Greek word askesis means practice. So it's like if you're a basketball player or you're a runner, you have to have practice to excel at these things. That's what that means. So the point of asceticism is actually practice and virtue, doing things, you know, practicing, for example, if one is angry and wants to say something destructive, exercising yourself and keeping your mouth shut at that moment would be one way of doing it. Also, another form of asceticism might be to, you know, save a little, spend a little less money on your own food and maybe help give it to the poor, the charities, the people who could use such things. You know, these are the kinds of things it's talking about. And if it's talking about things like fasting, other stuff, the idea is that so the mind, the spirit, the soul are directing the body and learning this proper polarity of how things are doing. It's practice and virtue. It's not meant to be extreme or absurd or something, but it's something if we want to be good at something, which is living a virtuous, meaningful life, we need practice in such things. And that's what this is about.
Now, what's interesting, of course, is that those that follow the religious beliefs will follow along with developing a virtuous life. I'm going to quote from the essay, "Those who believe that whatever pleases sensation is good and whose reason does not recognize virtue live their present lives gluttonously, leaving none of their good portion for eternity. Those who manage their lives with reason and self-control are distressed by misfortunes here, but save the better portion for eternity. So the gulf consists of the impassable logical necessity created by the choices made in this life. One who pursues pleasure in this life without repentance makes the land of good inaccessible to him throughout eternity. The bosom of Abraham becomes the calm harbor of refuge for those who sailed virtuously in this life." It's a really interesting comparison, is it? Because it's something that we may understand at a very basic level, taught perhaps at childhood. But when you reflect upon your life in your through, say, middle age, etc., it provides a very honest understanding of the simplicity of the teaching, but allows you to provide perspective and think, well, am I looking at a much bigger picture here, perhaps even reflecting on what might be coming in the future, but also what legacy I've left in my own life here on planet Earth? I just find it a very, very profound realization in life that whilst it might be making something very simple, complicated, it's not. It's this beautiful understanding that we are in control of our own destiny. Our soul is very, very real, and something that that is beyond our physical body. Now, without proposing a question just yet, I'm just noticing that what we should do is take a break. We'll regroup after it, and we'll go back into the detail here of Brian's work. It's just an incredible story, and it allows people to realize that something today is just as irrelevant as it was 1,700 years ago. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.
JDRF's vision is to create a world without type 1 diabetes. The type 1 diabetes community is at the heart of everything JDRF does. We were founded by the type 1 diabetes community. In the main, we are governed by the type 1 diabetes community, we're energised by the type 1 community, and we're accountable to the type 1 diabetes community. It's on their behalf that we exist, and it's on their behalf that we must succeed. JDRF exists to rid the world of type 1 diabetes. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. So for us, that means rallying all the resources and all the people and all the organisations required to make that a reality as quickly as possible. The world's best researchers, exciting innovative companies, and the passion of the type 1 diabetes community, then delivered through the health system so lives get better every day, day after day, until the day we find a cure. To everybody in the type 1 diabetes community, no matter your age or stage with the disease, whether you were diagnosed recently or a long time ago, we need you to know that we are here working on your behalf to deliver a world without type 1 diabetes as quickly as we can. Thank you to everybody who's supported JDRF in so many ways. You are making our vision of a world without type 1 diabetes possible.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride, but there's also a significant amount of pressure.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
Watching the sun come up, that's my time. I can have a cup of coffee, and every day is a new opportunity.
That's cool.
Your hands got so cool. Yay!
Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
This is Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, Professor Brian Fitzgerald, who has looked deeply into the writing of St. Gregory of Nyssa, who wrote the book or the story of the soul and resurrection some 1,700 years ago, updated, would you believe, for the 21st century. And we're delighted that Brian is able to join us today. Now, we are talking about, once again, living a life, your best life in your physical world, and perhaps saving something for eternity. Might not be everyone's cup of tea, but for those who practice religious faith, Christianity especially, this is something that is held dear to all of the fundamental beliefs, Brian.
Well, I think it's important. The key thing where Gregory of Nyssa is building is from, the narrative of the rich man and Lazarus, where, I don't think we need to go into details about that, but it is the rich man in eternity, in pain and misery and so forth. And he sees Lazarus in a state of blessedness. And so there's an explanation about how it came about this way. The rich man had all the good things in this life, Lazarus not. And so now eternity, things reversed. And a common explanation of this, which we see with Gregory of Nyssa, but also John Chrysostom will pick this up in another 20, 30 years, is that, from what Abraham is reputed to have said to the rich man, they said, well, in life you had your good things and Lazarus his bad things, and now in eternity he has his good things where you are where you're at. And the extrapolation of that, that's not necessarily in the gospel text itself, is that, well, the rich man basically blew everything in this short temporal life and had all his good here and saved nothing up for eternity. And so the key thing, I think, Greg Rivness and others, is not to be solely focused on accumulating just the good things in this life, to think beyond that. And I think that's probably a better way to take it, because I think if we take the approach, don't blow all your money now because you're going to need some tomorrow, you know, or looking at it kind of like a bank account kind of thing, probably it can be a useful motif. Okay, let's wait a little bit. Let's think there's a future to think about here. But if somebody is kind of tends to be a little depressive or punctilious, that could be a very legalistic approach also that could drive one a little nutty. The point really being, I think, is important to think of it in a positive way, is that we do have choices we can make in this life, and they affect us, our eternal fate. And, you know, so understand the Orthodox Church is that we are essentially, we understand humanity to be good. We're in fallen condition, but essentially we don't think humanity is essentially evil. We think it's essentially good, and yet we're fallen. And, you know, so it does take virtue and practice and effort to be able to work against the conditions dominated by death and sin as we are, or heavily weighed down by it. So it takes effort. In that sense, the asceticism or practice I mentioned earlier. The key thing also is to understand is that the afterlife of blessedness or of not so such blessedness is not a matter of location. Like, oh, you got into a bad block there, and you know, and unfortunately stuck, bad schools, everything else. Now, it's understanding, and this is actually typical of Eastern Orthodox Christianity, is what's being spoken of here is that conditions, one's spiritual condition. Is one in communion with God, or is one not in communion with God? Does one love one's neighbor, or does one not love one's neighbor? Is one oriented properly or not? And that's a spiritual condition. And that's actually as much true in this life as the next. So, in effect, one can even experience the blessings of eternity now, although in a limited way. The divide between now and eternity is not like this utter on-off switch, as we often think, but it's in eternity we will be free of many of the distractions we have now, so we'll enjoy or not enjoy so much what status that we to which we have grown spiritually. And we'll see that in its fullness in eternity. And so the point is that we are free to avail ourselves of God's grace and his mercy and his plan of salvation for us in the church, and to work toward that, not only for our own benefits, but for others. And by focusing on that, we're not only just concentrating on immediate satisfaction of needs now, but we will be working toward the good and the benefit of everybody and ourselves in the future. So it's a long-term thing. But it's something that we are able to do by God's grace. We do have an ability to choose these things and make these choices. And so it's not so much just don't squander all your money now. It's better to think of it as a kind of a focus. Do we want to just focus on this life only, or do we want to focus on this life and the next and the consequences that come with it? And think more in a long-term way, and realizing that we do have a say-so in what our outcome is, that we do can cooperate with the grace of God that has been offered to us in the church and avail ourselves of this. I think that's certainly, Gregory, I'm not going to disagree with that. That's fully agree with it. That's, I think, a good way to approach many of these things, you know, to see that, you know, our actions do make a difference and that we actually can act. We do have the strength to do that. I mean, God still has to be our savior. We can't save ourselves. But there has been an eternal helping hand that's been has reached out to us. We do have the ability to say, okay, I need the help. Help me. Instead of saying, get away from me. I don't want it. And that might be all we can do, but that's enough. And yep. So, yeah, we do have that freedom for that. And I think that's a key thing we need to understand.
Now, can we look at the soul in the afterlife, approaching the divine, as a contributor to God's universe at that point, or a passenger, meaning that it's just going along with a ride here? Is there a contribution to make in the soul? Is that being contemplated?
But what the idea of, I'll just speak to what's called theosis or divinization. It's better to think in terms of communion of the soul with God. That's a better way to start. Mm-hmm. We're not contributing anything to God. God doesn't need us. God created us because, well, out of a superabundance of love, perhaps, to be able to show willingness of goodness toward us. And of course, this is a choice of God's will to do so. God did not need to do so because he's had some lack otherwise. It's just something out of his goodness he chose to do. So we're not going to add anything to God. And in our growth toward God, as Gregory of Nyssa talks about, or what we will call divinization or theosis, we're not becoming God in the sense that we're being absorbed into some divine essence where we lose our individuality, we just become this massive divine thing. What we are is that since we're created after the image and likeness of God, our human nature then becomes fully divinized, which a good way to put that is that it's restored, body, soul, and spirit. The body is essential part of this, to its eventually to the ideal state to which God intended in the first place for us to grow into, but we chose not to do. So that's what it's saying. So it's we become by grace what God is by nature, is what some people will say. But the point is that there is a means that we are able, even though God is totally other than us and his utter essence is incommunicable with us, but yet through his grace, people say, or energies, as great Paulinus will say, you know, we are able to communicate with God and commune with God truly, although not with God's essence, but still truly in a way that transforms us into his image, to experience his fullness of image and likeness in body, soul, and spirit. And I think a key thing to also take away that Gregory of Nyssa, this is my one criticism of him, is that if you read him, you won't hear much that describes the body as a positive sort of thing that really contributes to salvation. I mean, you press him, you would, but you'd think the soul's where the action's at here. Well, the understanding of the Orthodox churches is body, soul, and spirit all have essential roles to play in our salvation, and that they're all good, and this is, and that's why there's a resurrection from the dead. Because there would, if the soul was all that mattered, there would need no need for a resurrection. The point is the body is good, and it's part of us, and we're not complete without the body. But the point is, after with the resurrection of identity, you know, it'll be not as we understand it now, but it will be the kind of human beings we were intended to be, in fully in communion with God, but yet, because we're fully divinized, we're actually more fully human than we ever were on earth. To be more divinely oriented is to be more humanly oriented. So it's not this sort of winner-take-all sort of thing, either God or human or whatever. It's a sort of the closer we become to God, the more human we become, the more fulfilled our human nature is. The understanding is well, what was human nature supposed to be in the first place? Mm-hmm. And see, that's what if we start understanding with that we were created after image and likeness of God, to be in communion with God and in communion with each other through that, then salvation is weaving us back together in such a way to experience that fully.
Now, can you explain if other religions talk about reincarnation, Christian religion talks about resurrection, in terms of the transmigration of souls, which I found fascinating?
Well, transmigrations of souls is a particularly Platonic take on, reincarnation, I guess you could call it reincarnation. This would have been one of the things that would have been one of the options Gregory had to deal with, because Neoplatonism and Platonism certainly were in a very living, active philosophical stances people might have taken. Yet now people might be informed by it, and it's hard to really think of anybody who was not being somewhat informed by it. But I doubt there are many people there's some. I know there's certain sectarian groups that believe in transmigrations of souls and so forth, but that's not a normal position people take these days. I believe there are religions that believe in reincarnation. I know there are plenty of people who believe it. It's at least, let's say, for Christianity and Western society, is not as usual. But I guess if you're dealing with, you know, I believe Buddhism and others have understandings of such things, but it's a very different way of looking at life, really. And a very interesting one, and very well, highly developed one. But for Christianity, there's no possibility, and this is utterly in category, and reincarnation and transmigration of souls are out. You know, there's sometimes that, you know, we say, oh, maybe there's a little wiggle room. There's no wiggle room. That is specifically excluded. Our decisions in life have to be made here. And if you're going to, in a way, think of a religion that's not an Abrahamic religion like Judaism or Islam, that where that point's very strongly made, that we might agree at least with its ethos, is Zoroastrianism, where you have to basically, it's sort of a dualism, where you have to make your choices, whether you're going to side it with good thought, good deeds, good actions, and that sort of stuff, or the bad thoughts, bad deeds, and so forth. It's an ethical choice you've got to make, and it's got to be done here, and there's no room for monkeying around. In a way, that's what Christian, you know, we're not Zoroastrians, but as far as in Christianity is concerned, we do have freedom to make choices, and we do have choices to make, and they cannot be put off. They have to be done here. I think that's the key thing to understand, is it has to be done here. And so there's, Gregory kind of indicates his take, why he doesn't like reincarnation, is that, well, it could make one rather lax in one's choices. You know, but, well, if I blew it here, you know, maybe I'll have other infinite chances. I don't know if people really seriously think that way. Oh, if I screw up in this life, I'll do it, get it right the next time around or something. That's an awful long time to make up one's amends. I would tend to think most people won't think that way. But I think the best thing to think is that I've got a choice. I have to make it now. There's no second chances. And so we better take it seriously. That's really, I think, the key driving thing to understand with Christianity and the rejection of a reincarnation or transmigration of souls. And, you know, then you go with other sorts of things. I think that's the most important thing to stress, but, you know, above anything else. He has a lot of philosophical points he makes, you know, like soul being born out of evil and things like that and so forth. I won't go into any details about that at this point. But I think the point is that we're free, and we have choices, but we do have choices to make, and it's important that we make them, and they've got it, and we have a time frame which to make them, which is our current life. And so reincarnation, transmigration, souls, forget it. Don't be silly. Make your choices now.
Now, Brian, you look at the world today, do you consider the possibility of the return of Jesus Christ in your lifetime being a possibility? Or is it something that you've never considered, that we're just living this brief existence and this is just part of the greater belief of Christianity?
Well, Jesus Christ is going to return. The age, current age, is going to come to an end, to an eschaton, towards its conclusion. It could be 10 seconds from now. It could be another 1,000 years or whatever. I got to admit, I'm probably like most people where I think, well, I know it's going to come, but, you know, probably a zillion years from now. That's probably how a lot of religious people feel. That's kind of, if I were to be honest with myself, that's how I feel. But it could be any moment. The church teaches that we've actually been in the end time since Pentecost. And that's what we need to understand. And it's very important that we don't get waylaid in the kind of what we call eschatological or end time mistakes. Like, oh, there'll be wars and rumors of wars. And they say, oh, he must be coming. No, he said, no, but the end is not yet. He specifically said that was not the sign. If it is, then, you know, why wasn't the 30 years war a classical end of history? Whenever human history, as God deems, has reached its fullness, whatever that might be, that's when it's going to reach. And that could be any moment. We don't know when. Gregory of Nyssa sort of posits that humanity will reach its fullest complete number, and at that point, they'll be reached done. I've heard other people say that when the last soul that could ever possibly get be saved is saved, then it will come. I never liked that one very much. It's like, what happens if they're 20 afterward, they're all doomed? It seems to me that those are kinds of things. When God sees it's complete and the time is up, the time is up, and it's best to leave these things in God's hands. And to realize that he says that the second coming will be as a thief in the night. It'll become unexpected. And so, yes, does it feel like it'll be 10 seconds from now? To me, I admit it doesn't seem that way, but it really could be. The important thing for us to understand spiritually is that, yes, it could be. And I do know in many Christian monasteries, you know, they emphasize this aspect of the end time to try to tell themselves we live in end times, because it helps your folk, if you take it properly and not scare yourself, the wits out of yourself. The point is to make yourself focused that we have decisions to make, and to make them now. And to make our spiritual decisions to focus on practicing good now. I think that's the healthy way of looking at it, and that's what's intended. And so that's why I think we should understand that the history does have an end. it does have a completion, which is coming. We don't know when it's going to be, but it is coming, and it could really be any moment. And that takes some reminding of ourselves, because in the normal humdrum of life, we don't feel that. And I admit I don't, really. But yes, at least intellectually, I acknowledge that it is the case.
Now, Brian, it's a wonderful summary of a wonderful piece of writing. If you'd like to get hold of Brian's work, it's on Connor Court Publishing. Simply Connor Court, Quarterly 17, St. Gregory of Nyssa, On the Soul and the Resurrection by Brian Ephraim Fitzgerald, PhD. It's been a thrill. Brian, thank you for your time today. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be back because after the break, Tess Corth will be with us to give us the latest on the Dublin FCI closure. Breaking news coming out of California. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.